This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It does what it says on its cyber door. You and I get briefed by the top experts on one of the big issues. And this week, the big issue is, will Russia invade Ukraine? Tens of thousands of Russian troops are massed close to the Ukrainian frontier, and Ukraine's forces be on high alert are not happy harbingers. The West is worried about a potential invasion. The Russian response is not deeply reassuring. So what's going to happen on the Ukrainian border, and how alarmed should we be about it? Step into the briefing room, and together we'll find out. Let's go back to the start. This is far from the first time there's been tension over Ukraine. Sarah Rainsford, who is the BBC's Moscow correspondent but was expelled earlier this year, is in the briefing room. Sarah Rainsford, let's briefly talk about history here. What is the big picture of Russia-Ukrainian relationships?
Well, in the very biggest picture, of course, Ukraine was part for decades of the Soviet Union. It had been an independent state very briefly after 1918, but it was then absorbed into the USSR. It declared its independence in 1991, August 1991, after a coup attempt in Moscow, and eventually became fully independent at the end of 1991 as the USSR fell apart. But there's been a long history since then, even, of Russian involvement in Ukraine and certainly Russian interest in what happens in Ukraine, and most notably in 2004 with the Orange Revolution there, when there were mass protests over a pro-Russian candidate who won. And then in 2014, of course, when that same man, Viktor Yanukovych, was ousted from office after he refused to turn Ukraine towards the West by signing an agreement with the European Union.
Now, in that 2014, that was the year that Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine and backed the rebels in the East. And that's 7 years ago. Why do you think we've got this flare-up now?
We should bear in mind, first and foremost, that there have been a lot of flare-ups, if you like. The conflict in Ukraine is unresolved. There are Russian-backed forces in eastern Ukraine who are fighting. There are deaths every day, most days, between those pro-Russian forces and the Ukrainian military. So the conflict itself within Ukraine still goes on. And then you've got this military build-up. And I think, you know, it just goes back to that whole fact that Russia, and particularly, I think, President Putin, has never quite come to terms with the fact of Ukraine as an independent state.
Now, what are the various ways since 2014 that Putin and Moscow have sought to influence events in Ukraine?
I think the most important way is by maintaining that conflict in eastern Ukraine. That is a massive thorn in Ukraine's side. That conflict, of course, first and foremost, has cost lives. More than 14,000 people have been killed in the fighting since 2014, and most of them military or Russian-backed rebels, but a huge number of people killed. And the conflict still bubbles on, and Russia has kept it that way. There is a peace treaty, a peace deal that was done, known as the Minsk Agreements, that was done very much at a time when Ukraine was on the back foot militarily. And Russia is pushing hard for that deal to be implemented. And if it were implemented, it would mean that Ukraine would become a federation and the Donbass region, where those Russian-backed forces control at the moment, would be incorporated, reincorporated into Ukraine, and would give Russia a permanent lever in Ukraine. Because the idea would be that there would be pro-Russian politicians then within Ukraine who would have a permanent veto on Ukraine's strategic decisions. So whether or not Ukraine joins NATO, whether or not Ukraine joins the EU. So essentially, Russia would retain a very big finger in the Ukrainian pie. Russia would permanently be able to fiddle with things there, have its sort of puppets within Ukraine doing its bidding. That's the kind of vision. And certainly if the deal were implemented as it stands, that's what would happen. That is exactly why, of course, Kyiv hasn't been able to implement it, because politically it would be suicidal for the current administration, the current leadership in Kyiv.
What do we know of what majority of Ukrainians feel about that agreement and moving further towards the West, NATO and the European Union?
Vladimir Putin talks about Ukraine and Russia as one nation. He talks about them as brothers, a fraternal relationship, although I think it was the Ukrainian president who said if they're brothers, then it's more like Cain and Abel than anything else. So they have this kind of supposedly tight relationship. But the fact is that since Russia essentially stole a big chunk of Ukrainian territory and began a war there, many, many Ukrainians have turned against Russia, as you might expect. They see Russia as hostile, the vast majority. More people now see Ukraine's future as with the West rather than with the East.
What do you understand to be the latest situation at the border?
Well, the picture that we have at the moment is primarily coming from US intelligence, which hasn't been disclosed. The data that has been made public suggests that there's been a build-up of something like 90,000 Russian troops at various points around the border of Ukraine, but actually quite a substantial number of those troops apparently in Crimea. There's a few satellite pictures that have been released. A Russian group that charts these kinds of things has also published some videos of troop movements, but certainly not as much as they were publishing back in April, for example, when there was a rather bigger, more substantial and more overt military buildup in a similar area of the country. So Russia is saying, you know, this is our country, we move our troops where we want, there's nothing aggressive, there's nothing threatening in all of this. But obviously the United States has looked at what's happening and has also listened to some of the language coming from Moscow and decided this actually is threatening action by Russia and that it preludes some kind of military offensive potentially in the beginning of next year. So that's why they've started sounding the alarm and certainly sort of sharing their intelligence behind closed doors with their allies and trying to call for a sort of joint response or resistance and the possibility of sanctions if Russia were to take major military action inside Ukraine.
Sarah Rainsford. Now let's try to look more closely at the Russian side of this equation. What is President Putin up to? Anton Babashin is a political analyst and editorial director of Riddle Russia, a journal that looks at Russian affairs. Anton Babashin, as far as you can see, what does Vladimir Putin hope to achieve with this build-up of troops close to the Ukrainian border?
There are two separate agendas here, one being related specifically to Ukraine, and that is Putin's and Kremlin's desire to fulfill the Minsk Accords and get that Eastern Ukraine, Donbass territory back into the Ukrainian state on Russia's conditions. The second agenda here would be a much larger one. It is basically Putin's personal desire to get Biden talking about a lot of major kind of big topics, one being Russian-NATO relations. And they presume that they have run out of options. And the only other option they have is essentially getting this situation to a point of near war to get dialogue going.
Is it your view that Vladimir Putin is actually planning for a conflict over Ukraine? And I suppose the question really is Vladimir Putin planning in any way to invade Ukraine?
The conflict has been ongoing since 1415. I don't think violence itself is the goal. I mean, there's no agenda to have a war for the sake of war. So if his objectives could be achieved without major bloodshed, that's more preferable. There would be less sanctions, less confrontation, less stress on the Russian economy. But if things do not exactly go as he hopes, violence escalation could not be excluded.
Under what circumstances could you imagine that there would actually be a significant incursion by Russian forces into the sovereign territory of Ukraine?
If NATO's position is firm, they're not going to change it an inch. Not even symbolic moves are possible. And, you know, you just need to back off. And here are the sanctions we're going to be imposing. That might sort of force Putin to act upon his, well, essentially promise of violence.
What are the set of changes that it wants to see? What are the guarantees that it is not just asking for, but which represent its minimum position that NATO would have to give?
Well, Kremlin is asking for NATO to promise not to expand any more eastward. I don't think that is possible. And it's probably not really what they want. What they want is essentially a new agreement on what forces could be deployed in Europe, what sort of drills could be held by NATO, and how basically we look at each other and we verify each other's actions. So they want essentially a Cold War type of agreement where one side and the other would respect each other as a foe or a partner in a stressed relationship, but everything would be pinned down to a document that would regulate how we cooperate and cohabitate in Europe.
Within the context of that, does that mean that Putin and other senior Russians don't really see Ukraine as a sovereign country with its own interests?
Oh, of course not. I mean, Putin has been quite open about it in a number of articles, a lot of statements over the last few years, essentially saying that, you know, the sovereignty of Ukraine is quite conditional. It is conditioned on Kremlin's goodwill. His treatment of Ukrainian sovereignty is questionable at best.
How do Russian people see this? And another question may seem naive. Does it matter how the Russian people see it?
Latest polls indicate that you have about 17% of Russians who consider that Ukraine should be part of Russia. Mostly they are the older generation of Russians, seniors, the folk that lived in the Soviet Union. But a majority of Russians, around 80%, consider that, you know, Ukraine should be an independent state. When it comes to war and fighting, you have a vast majority of Russians who actually oppose any confrontation that would lead to the Russian boot being on the ground. But as we know, in many instances before, public opinion does not always, I mean, it doesn't work exactly the same as it does in liberal democracies.
So why is he pushing now?
You had your expectations about Zelensky administration, who came in 2019. They didn't kind of...
Zelensky, the current president of Ukraine.
Of course, yes. You have Paris and Berlin basically not helpful. You have this change in the administration in Germany, you know, Merkel stepping down. You had Biden coming in some time ago, and you want to force him to basically determine what kind of relationship that would be. And economically, Russia is still kind of capable enough to do something radical at this particular moment, which might not be the case in 5, 6, 7 years, considering how the economy, the green economy, is developing and, you know, uncertainty about the future of Russian gas and oil.
The sense you're giving me is that Vladimir Putin might regard his time as running out to get a more favorable settlement in the area. Is that what it amounts to?
He considers himself a person of history, part of Russian history. He works in terms of the next century of Russian history, and thus he considers that something needs to be done in Ukraine before it's too late. There's an urgent sense that history is forcing him to act.
Would you describe Putin's tactics as having succeeded thus far?
It very much depends on how you frame success. I would say that his main objective here, and has been for the last 20 or so years, was to remain in power in Russia. And he has been quite successful. If we look at Ukraine specifically, being historically very close and now drifting apart because of Putin's own actions, then I think it is a failure. Whatever he accomplishes here today will make it very hard for whoever is the next Russian administration to normalize the relationship, not only with the West, but what is more crucial, I think, for Russia's own long-term objectives is the relationship with Ukraine. And that's going to be a very complicated puzzle.
Anton Barbashin. Right, let's bring together the various other threads. How is Ukraine itself reacting? And what are the Western powers thinking and doing? Joining me in the briefing room are Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri, director of the US program at Chatham House, Orisia Lutsievich, research fellow and manager of the Ukraine Forum in the Russia and Eurasia program, also at Chatham House, and Dr. Liana Fix, who's a Russia expert from the Kerber Foundation, an independent think tank based in Berlin. Leslie, what do you understand the American assessment of whether Moscow is genuinely threatened to invade Ukraine to be?
I think the Biden administration is very aware that when you've got the number of troops that we're seeing along the Ukrainian border, that one has to take this very seriously. Also, that it's entirely possible that regardless Putin's intentions today, that those intentions can change. So I think there's a laser-like focus right now on applying real pressure, threats of what might happen were that kind of escalation to take place, but also trying to engage Russia and give it some sort of off-ramp.
Orisia Lutsievich, is that perception of the threat the same as the one that Ukraine sees?
Ukrainians have been invaded by Putin already 8 years ago, and that all started right after the annexation of Crimea. So parts of Ukrainian territory has been chopped off already, and Ukrainians believe that there is actually a Ukraine-Russian war, and that war has been lasting now longer than the Second World War, with high toll on civilians, with a lot of displacement. At the moment, it's quite emotional, and there's a lot of anxiety, because a lot in Kyiv understand that Putin fails to achieve his objectives purely by putting more pressure on Ukraine, by unleashing vicious disinformation, by pressing for the Russian version of the implementation of Minsk Accords, and also working with the West, lobbying hard to split in this pro-Ukrainian alliance along the lines of keeping sanctions on Russia. So Ukrainians understand that Putin runs out of options, where his one best option that is remaining on the table is military escalation.
Liana Fix, can we discern a distinct European view about the dangers?
Well, I think the official talking points from the side of the European Union and its member states were very similar to the talking points of the United States. So it is about raising the costs for the Russian side and for the Russian president. It is about de-escalation, about dialogue to prevent a crisis. Then, on the other hand, we have also seen that there was a little bit of a different perception between the United States and Europe. Is it an actual plan of invasion that might take place, which seems to be the stance of the United States? Whereas on the European side, it is rather perceived as a bargaining chip that is built up to get concessions from the European side. And we've seen reports that there's a reluctance from some EU member states, including Germany, to draw up two specific sanctions out of concern that this is too early at this point and that we might give out a deterrence measure too early. But what is also important is that we are currently in a situation of transition in key European member states. Germany just had its elections. The new foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, just concluded her first week in office with a case of expulsion of Russian diplomats. And then we have elections in France next spring. So it is a difficult situation for Europeans to show the same level of leadership that they have shown in 2014. And there will be a need from the side of the United States to come in strongly in the diplomatic and political process, as they already do right now, to make up for this leadership situation in Europe at the moment.
Leslie Vinjamuri, there is a perception that this is not just about Ukraine, that actually Vladimir Putin is looking for other things as well. What else do the Americans think Putin is after?
Well, I think that there's long been a sense that Russia, that Putin would like to have a different place in the Euro-Atlantic security order, that this is being driven by a desire to bring the U.S. back into this conversation, to taking Russia very seriously, at a time when, of course, the U.S. is domestically preoccupied and in its foreign policy is very clearly reorienting itself towards China and to the Indo-Pacific. The U.S. knows this. It's why it's very clearly taken this so seriously. Because remember, part of America's desire right now is to be able to achieve a degree of settlement, of security, of stability across Europe, across the Middle East, so that it can very rigorously focus on what it sees as the number one challenge, which is clearly China.
Does that mean, Leslie, that if the Ukrainians were to want to join NATO, America would be very reluctant to permit that to happen, would find a way of avoiding it?
There's clearly an ambiguity that emanates from the U.S. over time on this question. But I think it's highly unlikely that the distant promise of Ukraine's membership in NATO is something that this administration would take off the table.
Orestia, how does that play in Ukraine? Do Ukrainians and Ukrainian politicians want to be part of NATO, and will they be pushing to do it anytime soon? Or do they share the kind of perception that maybe now and the immediate future is not the time?
Well, we are speaking at the 30th anniversary of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And since that Soviet Union collapsed, there is a security vacuum for countries like Ukraine that find themselves between the Euro-Atlantic community of collective security of NATO and increasingly aggressive Russia. And what happens over time is Ukraine is paying a higher price for being in that security vacuum. And this is where, you know, a lot of alarm bells are ringing in Ukraine and civil society and political elites in government saying, how do we actually protect ourselves from resurgent Russia? And everything Putin did in the last 8 years was pushing Ukraine to understand that Ukraine needs to become a member of a collective security architecture of the transatlantic community. And that support is actually growing in the population. You know, there's more than 53% believe Ukraine should be a member of NATO, when almost 8 years ago it was around a quarter of the population. NATO should not take away that option from the table just to appease Putin, because it will only embolden him even more.
Liana, that leaves a very kind of tricky situation for countries like Germany and France, which is the dilemma that the more Putin pushes at Ukraine not to be part of NATO, not be part of EU, the more it creates a situation whereby the population wants the guarantees of NATO and the EU. How do countries like Germany and France, and how does Europe perceive that dilemma?
Well, I couldn't agree more with Orestia that taking the perspective off the table of NATO membership due to Russian pressure would be certainly extremely problematic, because it would signal to Moscow that with building up a threat scenario as it does right now at the Ukrainian border, it can achieve its aims and it can dictate NATO and NATO member states how to proceed. When we look at the position of Berlin and Paris, both France and Germany have been opposed to NATO membership for Ukraine. From the Berlin perspective, a membership of NATO would lead to a potential conflict situation with Russia. And as we see right now, what would happen if Russia invades, there will be no military support from Berlin, from France, from other European member states or NATO allies in support of Kiev. We might speak about defensive weapon deliveries. That is certainly something that would be considered, but there will definitely not be European boots on the ground to defend Kiev, which makes the position all the more difficult. On the one hand, it wants to encourage reforms. It wants to bring these countries closer. But on the other hand, it is not able and not willing to give membership and security guarantees within the EU or NATO.
Now, Leslie, that suggests a position which is essentially stuck and stuck in a dangerous place. What do you think the West can do to de-escalate this situation without giving too much ground?
Well, I think there is this question of engaging in a broader confidence-building set of conversations. We've seen, you know, right from the beginning when Biden became president, one of the first things he did was to work with Russia to extend the New START treaty. So he's always had a view, and this is, you know, this is not limited to Russia, that there need to be, especially in the toughest diplomatic circumstances, two tracks, one that pushes very hard on deterrence And another one that really seeks to engage diplomatically to push forward things that are seen to be inherently good and important from the point of view of stability, peace, and security. And remember that in this case, if you take seriously the polling, for example, that came out of the Chicago Council last September, a majority of Americans, both Republicans and Democrats, would actually be willing to send troops and to support America intervening were Putin to invade Ukraine.
That's interesting, and some people might find it rather surprising. I want to ask all three of you a final question, which is that when you get a lot of troops on a difficult border, things can go wrong, even if people don't necessarily intend them to. In other words, the risk of miscalculation. Leanna Fix, what do you think?
I think there are two issues. The one is miscalculation, but the other issue is also provocation. There can also be an instance where an act is played up by the Russian side as a provocation or even engineered as a provocation to give legitimacy to any military action. And I think a tool that would be useful in this case, and which is, again, something which could be offered to the Russian side as part of a diplomatic and political process, is the OSCE monitoring mission, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which has been on the ground for a long time, but which has recently faced many obstacles, especially from the separatists and from the Russian side. If we want to take Russian concerns at face value, this is something that we should offer to Moscow and say, well, if you are concerned about provocation, we have the OSCE mission there, which can provide for both sides an element of stability.
Aristo Lutsievich, this is an existential question for Ukraine, so they must think quite a lot about the circumstances under which this all goes badly wrong. What are they specifically worried about?
Well, Ukrainians are preparing for resistance. They are training to protect critical infrastructure. Ukraine is working on boosting its territorial defense. At the moment, Kyiv downplays the possibility of an outright, full-fledged invasion, but a limited use of a military force is conceivable and it's being prepared for. Public opinion polling showing that a quarter of Ukrainians are ready to fight with the weapons in their arms to protect Ukraine. A lot of women are ready to join resistance movements. Ukraine has over 500,000 war veterans who have actually combat experience. But most of all, Ukrainians are staying calm. There are plenty of them preparing going, you know, on the ski trips to the Carpathian Mountains, knowing that Ukrainians in it for a long haul. Ukraine is prepared to defend its European choice of rule-based democratic country. Regardless of war, Ukraine is implementing democratic reforms to prove that it belongs to the Euro-Atlantic community of nations.
But isn't the fundamental difficulty, and this is my final question to you, Leslie, that the West can't actually give Putin the things that he wants? They can't give him his interpretation of the Minsk agreement, and they can't give him any guarantees that other countries won't join NATO.
That is a very serious challenge. You know, underpinning that is the concern that clearly Russia has under Putin's leadership for its sense of itself, for its status globally. And that's a very difficult thing to speak to. It's very difficult to guarantee. I think that this is, again, on the U.S. side, this is an administration that's deeply aware of this challenge. How do you give some sort of confidence to a leader who's clearly both aggressive and insecure, a very dangerous combination, while not giving away the things that the U.S. values, that NATO values, the sovereignty of Ukraine, its ability to choose its own future? So this is a tricky situation. All I can say is it's a much better time for this kind of situation than it would have been perhaps 2 years ago.
Under Donald Trump.
Exactly.
Leslie Vinjamuri there with Aristo Lutsievich and Leanna Fix. My thanks to them and to Sarah Rainsford and Anton Barbashin. And my conclusion? Let's hope everyone stays calm and keeps talking. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Chris Flynn and Kirstine Knight. The sound engineer was James Beard and the editor is Richard Varden. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently, we've discussed what's happening inside Afghanistan. We've defined what a variant is and how dangerous a new COVID one might be. And we've held our noses and explored the state of our rivers.
Sideways is back for another season with stories of incredible feats of endurance.
Mountain climbers, we plod onward through avalanches and snowstorms and occasional yetis.
I'm Matthew Side, and in Sideways, you'll hear stories of bold thinkers and amazing lives. Stories of seeing the world differently. Subscribe to Sideways on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.